Caroline Knowles to talk about her book, Serious Money. It looks at London being a plutocrat's paradise with more resident billionaires than New York, Hong Kong or Moscow. She says far from trickling down, their wealth is burning up the environment and swallowing up the city. Welcome to the show, Caroline.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. And what an interesting subject. What was your kind of inspiration for this book then?
I suppose because I'd lived in London a long time, the increases in wealthy people and luxury shopping and so on was becoming rather obvious. And against that, on the other side, so was the army of homeless and, you know, the people using food banks and so on. So it seemed to me that London showed really the coexistence of wealth and want. And I wanted to know if those two things were connected, and if they were, how they were connected. And of course, sociologists like myself mostly study the poor, and the implication being that they are the problem. But there now is a turn towards looking at the wealthy as well to see what contribution or, you know, what part they play in making the city and making collective prosperity. And I've been involved in an earlier academic study called Life in the Alpha Territories, which tried to begin and look at the impact of the rich were having on the city. But when we finished, I didn't feel we got close to who the rich are as people and how they think about themselves and London and other people. And I was curious to know more, to actually meet them and to begin to understand their world. And that gave rise to this book.
So you must have met some really interesting and eye-opening people then.
I certainly did. Where do I begin?
can you tell us? Can we have an example?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I suppose I should say first that I kind of walked what is a vortex of wealth across London from east to west, places where money is made and spent. And so I went through some obvious bits of the city, trying to have close encounters with the streets and the people and speaking to millionaires, billionaires, aristocrats and their hangers-on and their serving class. And I met a whole cast of interesting people. I met, for example, Bags and Barber, who are part of the Young Chelsea set, the children of very wealthy property speculator parents. I was quite surprised, really. I mean, I learned a lot about, you know, where, how long they sleep and how they use the city and whether they stray outside of Chelsea, the answer to which is not much. But I was quite surprised at how traditional they were, both in terms of their gender roles and their sort of lives and aspirations were really very straightforward. I suppose I imagined that wealth released people from the mundane, but it seems to tie them ever tighter to it. This shown in other characters I met as well. So it seems like they have a bit of a failure of imagination, but were being trained by their parents with the right connections and the right strategies for making money. So here I saw, you know, the next generation of plutocrats being made and consuming in quite conventional way, watches, Tom Ford suits, designer handbags, you know, all the things you would expect. Rather than something more interesting. And I suppose this is exactly how wealth is kind of grown and amassed among young people. But I was a bit surprised. I thought the young generation might have new ideas and new ways of living.
That's fascinating, isn't it? So the younger generation, the wealthy ones, a lot of the ones that you're talking about have been born into wealth and are just kind of following in the footsteps of their parents in a way then.
Yes, it would seem like that. While not being particularly happy about it, that seemed to be what they do. I also met a woman I call Elgin. I give everyone Elgin. I give everyone false names, a bit like Canterbury Tales, because I promise not to reveal who they are. And with lawyers, we went to great lengths to make sure no one could guess who the characters were, because they were guaranteed anonymity. But I was kind of interested by the women too, because there's lots of work on bankers and how they make money. But how the women live alongside them, I thought was rather interesting, because many of them would have had or had quite high profile careers before they became particularly, married to wealthy men. And then they become COOs, running wealthy families. You know, people spoke of 100 entry spreadsheets, which are necessary to keep up the pool, the children's tutors, the gardens, the decor, and so on. I learned a lot about the work which they don't do themselves, but they subcontract. Keeping up multiple homes is vast amounts of work. Rearing the next generation of plutocrats. Children's success is very much the metric by which wealthy women are measured. And so, you know, keeping up with their schooling and positioning them properly and making sure mothers are involved in schools, elite public schools often like Eton and so on. And of course, you know, women stand as they age, the possibility of being discarded for younger models. So their stories are rather interesting, full of those kinds of secondhand achievements and anxieties, which I thought was rather interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And the million-dollar question is, are they happy?
No, I was surprised, actually. I mean, to find that, you know, their secretiveness... they're secretive not just about the way they make and spend their money, but the ways they live. I mean, to live in gated situations, to not want to talk about things, to travel, you know, in private ways, in sort of bubbles of private jets and yachts and, you know, other forms of privatized travel, to be driven around the streets of London by chauffeurs. It shows that they are, in a sense, quite secretive, quite separate, perhaps, from the rest of us. They display quite high levels of anxiety about keeping away from other people, about being cheated by those who work for them. You know, is the yacht guy on the take? Is the butler nicking stuff from your room when you're not there? You know, when you've got so much stuff, it's very hard to keep track of it. And the butler, one of the characters in the book, tells spine-chilling stories of plutocrats throwing tantrums because they can't find a suit, even though they never wear it. They also have anxieties about looking rich properly. Party is one of the characters who tells this kind of story. Are the candles the right kind? You know, is the mayonnaise homemade enough? You know, what have they got, a 5-course rather than a 4-course? Dinner are they throwing? And those kinds of things seem to matter very much. So looking rich properly seems to be a source of anxiety. And of course, to cap it all, really, who needs to be driven around London by elite troops, you know, who used to operate in theatres of war? Do you need an ex-SAS driver to take you around a safe city? Really, these people are just clearing the way and keeping the public away. So it seems that, you know, there are a host of anxieties about being rich and keeping rich and being rich properly. Yeah. And so.
And what kind of response did you get from the people who work for these people, whether they're drivers or housekeepers or that kind of thing?
I suppose it depended who they were. You know, architects and designers perhaps tell us, these are people who are quite well paid, but people who aren't butlers and sort of people that wait on them. I think the stories that they tell are that they're often very difficult, that they change their minds and that they expect to have exactly what they want, no matter what the circumstances. You could be on a yacht, but if you want white chocolate biscuits, as one of them told me, then that's what you want, and you can't not have them. So they seem very much a kind of childlike, you know, my needs must be serviced at the expense of everything else. And that's certainly how a lot of staff saw them. They treated staff with varying amounts of respect. Sometimes they weren't respectful at all of their time, but serving staff were just waiting at their pleasure. They might have to stand outside their bedroom all night, just waiting in case there's a new order comes from within and something is needed. And heaven forbid someone should fetch it themselves.
Yes. Oh, it's awful, isn't it? Because you'd hate to think that is always the case. I mean, were there some nice stories, some really lovely, wealthy people that were doing good things both in their community and also were kind to the people who worked for them?
Yes, certainly. I mean, the thing to say about the super rich is they're as varied as anyone else. And of course, there are those who are socially conscious and concerned, who insist, although they're not required to pay more tax, who insist on paying more tax in making fair contributions to the public finances, so that it helps out with things like, you know, poverty and so on. And, you know, the women that I met in Notting Hill were volunteers. You know, they worked in the local community centres. They helped out during the Grenfell Tower fire, and they felt enormous sympathy, and they put in a lot of time for the people that they worked with. So it's by no means a uniformly bleak picture. There are all sorts out there, and you know, those are the people you'd want to encourage and work with, the people who are socially conscious, who don't spend their money on yachts or expensive handbags, but insist that it's spent properly.
Fantastic. Do you think there was could be more people like that, though? Do you think it was overwhelmingly the other side?
It's hard to know, you know, because it was such a small study. I suspect that all sorts coexist. But I think what could happen, given, you know, environmental concerns, that we could lean on people's conscience about their carbon footprint. You know, constantly renewing things and buying things all the time is not great for the environment. And I think that a kind of social and environmental consciousness could spread through these kinds of channels, you know, with some effort. But I think it would take some effort. And also there could be, you know, political manoeuvres to ensure that people pay fair amounts of tax and council tax and so on, and that everyone contributes fairly. So I think we need to change the structures and the people will change.
Yeah. Did you see a big difference between the way people lived if they had a couple of million compared to billions?
Oh, yes, I think that, yes. You know, there are unimaginable piles of money in some households. And, you know, those people were very busy with multiple homes and yachts and, you know, all sorts of things. Whereas, you know, the lower end of the 1%ers and high net worths, because it goes, you know, really quite low down the spectrum, were much, you know, more ordinary in their lives and what they do. So you do see a big difference, I think.
Mm. And do you think it would be obvious meeting these people in the street? I mean, you know, there's a kind of, we often hear that people who are really wealthy don't always dress as such. You know, you can see someone who's really wealthy and you wouldn't know it. They might have dirty shoes, wearing a cap, you know, a t-shirt with a hole in it. I mean, literally the opposite to what you would expect. Did you notice that?
Yeah, I think that I've got stories like that from, you know, the hotel managers who find it impossible to know whether someone is a tramp or an aristocrat. You know, it's really difficult. They dress fairly similarly sometimes, you know, so it is actually quite hard. And I think people often don't want to look visibly rich. I mean, the ones you would meet in the street, I'm talking about, the ones who glide by in the blacked out windows of the limousine are, of course, a different matter. So I suppose you wouldn't meet them in the street anyway. But I suppose those who do use the streets perhaps try to lessen the optics on the difference between them and other people.
And did you notice a difference in attitudes between people who were born into money and people who made their own money?
Oh, yes. People who are born into money have a sort of confidence about how to be rich. And often they kind of provide role models unofficially, of course, but sometimes more officially through butlers and things like that for people who are newly rich, who, you know, are not quite sure how to spend their money, you know, and who are worried about that. There are some people who aren't worried about that, you know, famously footballers' wives buy what they want and do what they like. But there are newly rich people who worry about looking rich properly and living rich properly. And they certainly use the hereditary wealthy as a kind of model for how to do things.
And I've met a few people over the years who have made their own money, you know, who have come from nothing and have a great story to tell, who really kind of feel entitled in a way, you know, that they've worked hard and therefore people should look after them and should look up to them in a really not very nice way.
Yes, I think perhaps the most entitled are those who've come from rags to riches, you know, and there are examples of that. You know, I mean, the Barclay twins, for example, started off quite poor, didn't they? And then, you know, here they are owning all sorts of things. And, you know, that I think that does make a difference, and live offshore and, you know, don't worry about paying tax and so on. So probably those things matter, that people who've made money think they've made money often because they are special or very talented or clever. Of course, what I realized doing this research is, well, that, you know, that may partly be true, but also, you know, the odds are stacked in their favor. There are systems which are open to them that aren't open to other people. Mm-hmm. For example, extreme forms of property speculation and certain financial instruments that only the rich can afford to play with, which gives them unequal access really to those kinds of riches. So, but I think often those who are self-made believe that they're special and better and so on.
Yeah. There's often a lot of luck that comes into it. I mean, I know a lot of wealthy people and entrepreneurs particularly will say that, you know, and rightly so, you have to work really hard to become successful and earn a lot of money. You know, you don't just have an idea and then suddenly you're a millionaire. You know, there's a lot of work, there's a lot of trial and error that goes into it. But often luck can play a huge part as well.
Yes. Now, I think that's true. And luck was an often used word in interviews. You know, people would say, well, I was just lucky, or things aligned in a particular way, which is quite a humble way of owning your wealth. So that, you know, often that would be the case, that people thought in those terms. But yeah, I guess.
Yeah. And through your research and the writing of the book, has it changed your view on money and wealth? Do you feel differently about it now?
Well, yes, I do. I hadn't quite fully appreciate until I did this work that it's not just that, you know, there are the rich and then there are the poor, but actually they're connected by the ways in which systems work. You know, it is a system issue which could be addressed politically. And so I think that slightly changed my outlook. But also, you know, you can't avoid a kind of envy as well. You know, who wouldn't like a floating glass staircase? You know, I started looking at people with lots of money, you know, you think, well, that's kind of interesting. But once you piece that together as part of a bigger landscape, that actually their wealth is generating dispossession and poverty for other people, then I think you do think about it as a more of a zero-sum game and something you'd like to be a bit more equal.
Mm. It's certainly not the be-all and end-all, is it?
No, it certainly doesn't bring happiness.
No. No.
It's a cliche, I know, but it certainly doesn't. You know, it brings anxiety and discontent and the need to be rich. And, you know, the other thing to say, sorry, you were saying earlier about them working very hard. That's true. I suppose I also had this idea that the rich were kind of idle in some ways. That could not be further from the truth. Obviously, some of them are. But actually, the majority of workaholic, they don't know how to stop work, even though they no longer need any more money, that they have all the money they could ever possibly spend. But they go on accumulating because I think in a way they don't know what else to do, which is kind of sad as well.
Mm. And it's probably addictive as well.
I would think so. The adrenaline hit of, you know, gambling on investments and making a lot of money and then losing money and then making still more money must have, you know, a kind of hit to it. And it is very much a, you know, a male game. It's not that there aren't, you know, women who make wealth in their own right, but it is a testosterone fueled kind of competitive sport that is particularly suited to certain kinds of men.
Yeah. Oh, it's fascinating. It's been great having you with us on the programme. Caroline Knowles, thank you very much for joining us. And if listeners want to get a copy of Serious Money, Walking Plutocratic London, it's available on our website, tre.radio. Caroline, thank you for being with us.
That's okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.